The first case of the day for the Southern Nevada panel, that is Lesnick versus State of Nevada, Supreme Court case 84577. Good morning, gentlemen. You all ready to proceed?
Yes.
All right, give me just a moment while we get settled here. All right, and Mr. Owens, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, I did, 3 minutes.
3 minutes? Okay, very well. And you guys know the clock will ding for you when you get down close to the time. All right, Mr. Owens, you can go ahead and proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Steve Owens, representing the appellant Ronald Lesnick in this case. Mr. Lesnick was convicted of three counts, to include a gaming offense, grand larceny, and theft for conduct which amounted to this. In the Wynn Casino, he approaches a high payout slot machine. He sees or discovers that there is unused credit still on the machine. He presses the payout button on the machine, receives a ticket, which he then takes and redeems for cash. He didn't try to conceal any of his conduct. He used his real name, his real identification, in order to receive the monies. In fact, later when he was approached by Gaming Control, he freely admitted that he saw nothing wrong in what he had done. He never claimed that he had wagered any money on the machine. He simply believed that the credits that he had found were abandoned and that he had a right to then take them, somewhat like what we were told in kindergarten: finders, keepers, losers, weepers. Or if he had found some money on the sidewalk, he, in his mind, believed that he had a right to simply take this money and depart with it. And for that, he's now spending time in prison. He's languishing there today. At most, this conduct amounts to one count. The state's best option here is to come out of this with one count, certainly not three. And that's because the legislature and double jeopardy clause together have specified that there shouldn't be more than one count here. Specifically, grand larceny is subsumed within comprehensive theft, where the legislature in theft said this encompasses a single offense for all similar larceny type crimes. So larceny and theft really are one and the same. You don't get two counts.
But counsel, what about the argument that the grand larceny was committed against Winters and the theft was committed against the Wind, two different victims?
Well, then double jeopardy turns on the way in which the state pleads the case and the way in which they name the victims. The victim in this case was made whole. He testified that the Wynn reimbursed him $3,000. And so I think you can play fast and loose. Who was the victim? Was it the casino? Was it the person who had been playing it? Was it the state? Apparently there was money escheats to the state at some point. That's not part of the double jeopardy analysis, is who's the victim. It's the legislature that says these offenses, there's only one. There's one comprehensive theft. It takes into account larceny. It doesn't depend on the victim, or you're double dipping if you can just name as many victims as you want and base the statute on that. I think that also looks at a multiplicity issue there as to how many counts of, let's say it was, they just charged grand larceny. Would they get three counts of grand larceny because maybe they can come up with three victims or two victims? No, there's no basis in any of the statutes to base the number of counts on the number of victims. And the legislature said that theft is a single offense. More importantly, in the gaming statute, that's a more specifically applied statute that carries a greater offense. And the legislature in both grand larceny and theft limited punishment for those crimes to situations where they could not be held criminally liable for a greater offense, which gaming is.
Are the elements for theft and grand larceny different?
Well, we can debate that. They don't use the exact same language, so the language is very, very similar. We can debate that ad nauseum. As I understand the double jeopardy test in Jackson, looking at the elements, the Blockberger test is the fallback position, only if the legislature did not specifically articulate that we intended this to only be one a crime. I gave the analysis in the brief. It's maybe a little more difficult to see. I do believe that they are all subsumed within, certainly grand larceny is within theft. Theft required the intent to permanently deprive the owner thereof, plus a material misrepresentation. So certainly grand larceny falls within that. It's gaming's got this admixture of the intent to defraud, which is similar to the material misrepresentation. So it's not entirely clear on the elements. I think I still win on an elements-based approach, but we don't get there because the statute is such that it says you only get one of these. Grand larceny and theft only apply if there's not a greater penalty provided for another statute, which they did. They charged gaming here. I don't think there was even sufficient evidence to convict the defendant here of any of these crimes. They're all specific intent crimes, which is difficult to prove. The state has that burden of coming forward and showing the specific intent to defraud for gaming, intent to deprive the owner permanently thereof for grand larceny and theft, plus that material misrepresentation. I don't see that on the facts of this case. I don't know how the jury could have come up with those elements. And so I think the jury got it wrong, and this is one that there's insufficient evidence for. Merged in with that issue is this idea that the jury didn't even deliberate the correct issues because they weren't properly instructed on the theory of defense, which the defendant quite clearly told the gaming agent, I thought they were abandoned. I found them. I thought I had a claim of right to these. The law that the jury did not hear is that an honest, even if mistaken, right of claim or a belief that you have a claim in property negates the specific intent for these crimes. That's what the defense was. That's Mr. Lesnick's basis from day one when he was approached by gaming control. That's what he said.
Are you suggesting that the district court did not provide an accurate definition of abandonment?
Yes, the instruction that was given on abandonment is from a civil case. Whether or not the property was truly abandoned is not the issue in a criminal case. It's whether the defendant honestly believed that it was abandoned, because that negates the specific intent. In a criminal case, that's what we're looking at. Civil, it may depend on the intent of the person as to whether or not they abandon it. The victim in this case, Bradley Winters, whether his intent was to abandon the credits or whether he just misplaced them. In a civil case, that would have some merit, but not in criminal. We're focused solely on the defendant's intent to defraud. And if he honestly believed it's a mistake of defense, or a mistake of fact defense, which Nevada clearly recognizes, if he honestly believed that he had a claim of right to this, which many people might, who aren't familiar with Nevada and the casinos. Mr. Lesnick, his identification was from Arizona. He thought he had a claim to this. He was probably mistaken. That issue's not before the court. It's whether it was honestly mistaken. The jury never got to determine that. In fact, the jury was instructed to the contrary, that they could not consider his subjective belief. If you look at the instruction they were given, the counsel objected to on ignorance of law. The last line is, it is no defense that he did not know that his act was unlawful or that he believed it to be lawful. That's contrary to Mr. Lesnick's defense. No one in the courtroom caught this. His own attorney, which I hate to wait until habeas to address that. If need be, then he will. But I think the error is in front of the court right now. The jury did not consider the legal issues in this case of what the evidence actually presented itself. The judge, the prosecutor, no one stepped forward and say, you know what, this is really what Mr. Lesnick's defense is, as he said it to the gaming agent.
How do we view that for appellate purposes? I mean, it seems to me that it's plain error review then, because it was unobjected to below.
It was unobjected to. There was an objection to the abandonment instruction that was given, but counsel didn't make the argument that I'm making here today, did not proffer this specific mistake of fact defense or indicate how abandonment interplays with the specific intent element that the state had to prove. So, yeah, I think you have to look at it in terms of plain error. And I think it's there. The law is pretty clear. The jury didn't deliberate on the defendant's theory of defense, which he put forward to gaming control, even if the attorney didn't advance it properly. I think it's the pulse of this court, even on direct appeal, to reverse that. The abandonment claim that was given and the ignorance of the law instruction that were given were in error. Those were not the issues that the court should have given to the jury.
Well, let me ask you a question before we get too close to your rebuttal time. The testimony of Mr. Kim that was read into the record from the preliminary hearing.
Yes.
How do you, or would you, proposed that the court harmonize the Drummond case and the statute, since the statute seems to reflect that preliminary hearing testimony, even if somebody was representing themselves in proper person, would still be allowable, versus Drummond, that seems to have an element that says somebody must be represented by counsel before a transcript can be used later.
I'm not sure I'm familiar with Drummond, but I think the test is they either have to be represented by counsel, or you have to show that they affirmatively waived counsel, and maybe a canvas that, hey, this testimony might be used against you later.
Yeah, it seems that nobody really provided anything in the record on appeal about what happened in justice court.
Well, there was a Feretta canvas. There was a Feretta canvas, right?
I don't think it's in the record before the court, and I wasn't there, and that would be outside of the record at this point. I'm sure the state wants to fault me for not providing it in the record, but my point is they had a duty to put it into the district court record. If they wanted to affirmatively use that testimony, they had to show the district court judge that he had affirmatively waived in justice court. They didn't do that, so I think the record as it stands shows the district court judge erred in not making that finding.
The only thing I recall from the record, and either side can comment on this, is that in the October 20th of 2021 district court minutes, there's a reference to the court beginning a Feretta canvas, at which point counsel, and I think it may have still been Mr. Hart, makes reference to a Feretta being done before, which would seem to be an allusion to justice court. But I would agree that there isn't anything else in the record about what happened in justice court that led to the gentleman representing himself.
And I don't know that it's enough to know that a Feretta canvas was done. Was it a legally adequate canvas? Was he specifically advised that his testimony or this testimony that he's cross-examining now on his own could be used against him later on? This might be admissible, and that's part of the waiver of the right to counsel. I don't know if that was included in any colloquy that the judge may have gone over with him. So I think procedurally there it's defective. Also, you know, on that issue, I think their motion was untimely. I understand COVID. They found out late that the witness was unavailable, but they were able to file a motion. It did not have an affidavit. The statute requires an affidavit. And if they can file the motion, they could file the affidavit. And if they get additional information the day before the hearing, well, supplement the affidavit. But I don't think they can show up on the day of the hearing and say there was no time over the last 4 days that we could have filed an affidavit.
Counsel, my understanding is that Lesnick did actually cross-examine Kim at the preliminary hearing. Now, it wasn't as thorough as maybe yourself as an experienced lawyer would have done. Do we need to consider the quality of the cross-examination, or is the opportunity to cross-examine enough under Drummond?
I think the Supreme Court simply requires an opportunity to cross-examine. It doesn't depend upon the quality of that examination, but it needs to be one where he's advised that he's waiving counsel and that it might be used later.
And your position is that that wasn't established in
It wasn't established in district court. I think it's too late to try to establish it now. This court's not a fact finder. There's no further questions. I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Any questions?
Nope.
No. Good. We'll add 2 minutes to your time because we use up a lot of questions, and we'll give 2 minutes to Mr. Beaumont as well.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Austin Beaumont, and I'm representing the state. To begin with, Mr. Lesnick was Feretta'd on August 27th, 2020, by, to the best of my recollection, Judge Joseph Sesento. He came in to provide a bit of a neutral party so that he could perform the Feretta canvas of Mr. Lesnick. Once that Feretta canvas was completed, Daniel Bunin was appointed as standby counsel, and then the preliminary hearing went forth on September 29th. So Mr. Lesnick had over a month to prepare after the Feretta canvas for that situation.
Would you agree, though, that that's not in the record on appeal?
I would agree that it's not in the record on appeal. It is reflected in the minutes of the justice court. Had it been an issue that was raised at the district court or trial level, we would have pulled the minutes from the justice court and provided them to the district court, but neither Mr. Lesnick nor Mr. Hart nor Mr. Bunin at any point challenged the notion that he was not given a full and fair Feretta canvas.
Right.
And regarding the multiple punishments for the same offense. I would take issue that these are very factually different as far as the facts and elements that support the portions of each one of these charges. First off, the gaming violation was complete factually when Mr. Lesnick hit the cash out button, thereby taking something from the machine that he had not wagered on. There was no factual discrepancy. He admitted to Agent Lee Hagenbu that he played this machine without having wagered any money on it. And by taking that ticket from it and cashing it out, the crime there was complete. The intent to defraud becomes a bit of a quasi-victim issue because within our reply briefs, or within our respondents brief, the win is listed as a victim, but the statute is not specific that it has to be the casino that is the victim that is the subject of the intent to defraud. It could be the person who's playing. It could be someone who perhaps is reselling these tickets on the street. There's no specific.
Can it be both?
Pardon?
Are they mutually exclusive? Can you have both a victim of the casino and the player who left the machine to go get help?
That would be beyond the facts of this case for me to speculate. My best speculation on this is that it's either one or the other regarding the intent to defraud. But the crime itself is complete at the moment of the taking of the Tito ticket, which is a bit redundant, the ticket in, ticket out ticket. But it's what Mr. Lesnick did after that that provides the facts and the elements to support the grand larceny charge and the theft charge, because the grand larceny charge under Blockberger has an element that the gaming violation does not, which is the taking and carrying away. Had he not left that area, had he not gone somewhere else in the casino, tried to cash it in first at an ATM where no one would be interacting with him, the grand larceny charge might not have stood. If he had perhaps taken the ticket out of the machine and been immediately caught by security, no grand larceny because there's no carrying and taking away. So that wouldn't have been supported under these facts. But then he went even further when Mr. Lesnick left the ATM after being rejected from the ATM and went to the cashier. And that's where we have the other element that's not present in either grand larceny or in the gaming violation crime, which is the material misrepresentation, being that he was entitled and legally authorized to get the money in payment or rather in exchange for this Tito ticket. So all of these crimes, though it sounds like it's one event of taking a Tito ticket and cashing in, there are several very different beginnings and ends to each one of these crimes.
But what about counsel's argument that it's double jeopardy?
It's not double jeopardy because under the Blockberger analysis, each of these crimes is not a lesser included crime of the other. They're separated by victim in the information because it also helps to separate out how these elements are applied regarding the facts of each. The grand larceny as to Mr. Winters being the taking away of the Tito ticket that was loaded with his own money, the theft being the material misrepresentation, and all of these individual crimes could have occurred completely independently of each other. So under the double jeopardy analysis and under Blockberger, there is no lesser included offense. There is no ability to, for example, commit the gaming violation and necessarily include the theft and necessarily include the grand larceny crimes. Again, for example, he could have taken this ticket from the machine, left the casino entirely. At that point, the grand larceny is complete, the gaming violation is complete, but the theft is not necessarily complete because he hasn't exchanged a Tito ticket for anything of value. If he tries to scalp it to someone outside, say sell it for half of his value, that's another analysis entirely. But because of that, you can easily craft a factual situation where none of these things are necessarily included with the commission of the other. So also to counsel's point regarding the higher offense, including the lesser, again, the gaming violation is complete when the intent to defraud, the taking, and the removal of that Tito ticket are all temporally present.
As to the testimony of Kim, was there any investigation by the state as to the witness's ability to participate via video? Was he asymptomatic? Did it go that far? And it was quite short notice in terms of his non-appearance in person.
It was. And to the best of my recollection, and I was sworn under oath, so I'm doing the best of my recollection from both being there and being on the record. We received his oral promise to appear. He was asymptomatic. He had no reason to think that he would not be there. When my process server tried to reach out to Mr. Kim again to ensure, hey, we're going to need you for the trial, he is then very symptomatic. We could not serve him. We could not get him in front of anyone. As far as him testifying via video, that was something I don't believe that we were able to set up on a short notice because we did not have the ability to either file the motion to appear by audiovisual means because we were mid-trial, or Mr. Kim was unable to do it technologically.
Do you think Mr. Lesnick was prejudiced by the inability to have Mr. Kim appear live and be cross-examined?
No, because he had a full and fair opportunity to cross-examine him himself at the preliminary hearing. So just as he can't complain that he was ineffective on appeal for representing yourself, I don't think Mr. Lesnick has a basis to claim that he didn't have a full and fair opportunity to examine at trial because he may have not questioned Mr. Kim as thoroughly as a seasoned attorney would. I think if you're not permitted to make that argument on appeal, it should apply from the preliminary court level to the district court level as well.
So let me segue you into the question that I asked Mr. Owens about in terms of Drummond and then the statute. And Drummond's not the only case, obviously, but the line of cases involving Drummond that stand for the proposition that to use a transcript later of sworn testimony, it lays out three elements: that the accused must have been represented by counsel, there was an opportunity for a full opportunity for cross-examination, and then the witness is unavailable. Our statute seems to speak not so much to that first element of they had counsel, because it speaks to the ability to have waived counsel. But Drummond seems to be kind of explicit. So how do you harmonize those two things or not?
I would harmonize them by saying that any incompatibility or notion that this would prevent Mr. Lesnick's cross-examination and questions and so on being used, being an issue that he has waived via the Feretta canvas originally in the preliminary hearing. If you're going to claim as the defendant that you had to have been represented by counsel, you can't initially waive your right to counsel and then take on all of the potentially negative consequences thereof and then claim that you are not aware of it. That was the purpose of the Feretta canvas in the first place, to inform the defendant that yes, you do have the right to represent yourself, but there are a number of rights and a number of privileges and a number of things that you're waiving because of the decision to do so. So by waiving that affirmatively up front, I think that that effectively takes care of that element of Drummond, saying that it's not necessarily a literal, actual separate counsel that is representing you. Just as you're able to waive any number of different rights by representing yourself, I believe the notion that you have to have a separate counsel is disposed of by that waiver.
So basically you would propose we not overrule Drummond, but just clarify it by carving out that exception to accommodate constitutional right to representation, self-representation not being used as both a sword and a shield.
Correct. And that was one of the issues that came up mid-trial when we were Mr. Hart and I were speaking with Judge Israel. This was a question that was raised regarding whether Mr. Lesnick's questions, whether they were or were not statements.
That's going to be my next question. What, if anything, was there, because I didn't see it in the record, as to why Judge Israel chose to allow that to go to the jury as the defendant represented himself, here's his questions, as opposed to sanitizing those things, which would have seemed to have been very easy to do?
The recollection I have from Judge Israel's explanation of why he was permitting that to go forward is, if a defendant is represented by counsel and a counsel asks a poorly worded or a vague question that opens the door to a certain answer, then that question can then come into the record as context for why a defendant answered that way. So by going through that analysis and saying if a counsel's question can come in as to contextualize what the defendant's response was, then by representing yourself, your own questioning also comes in under that same analysis. Regardless of whether the question was phrased as artfully as it could have been done, there's no shield to prevent that from coming in. Again, you're representing yourself at your own peril, depending upon what doors you're opening by your own line of questioning.
Well, my concern is that the way it was used is that, because earlier you had filed a motion to proposing to get in the defendant's questions at the prelim as statements, and that was denied and it was never re-raised. And then there was the motion to admit Kim's testimony, which was done. And then in closing argument, you referred to the defendant's questions as his statements. The jury is told that questions are not evidence. They're only admitted to give context to the answer that's given, which is the actual evidence. But the argument here to the jury seemed to be that the defendant's questions were actual evidence because they were his statements, as opposed to had the court just sanitized the questions to reflect, did the defendant do this instead of did I do this? It seemed that that would have been a much cleaner way to present that.
And I think that, again, goes back to the context analysis that Judge Israel was going through of a number of Mr. Lesnick's, and I'm going to put air quotes about them, questions, came in as the form of statements, i.e., when I took this from you, when I did this, when I did that. So by the manner of his questions, they became inseparable from the question itself because his questions became effectively admissions of his interaction in the process. And there's not much of a way to sanitize or to recontextualize what he was saying. But again, we went back to the analysis and what Judge Israel ultimately agreed with was the defendant's questionings, the defendant's statements, whether in trying to create a con, I'll start the answer again. When you're using yourself as context of what happened, it's effectively impossible to walk that back and say, well, when I took this thing from you and when I didn't tell you that it was stolen, there's not much way to take that and sanitize that. That's the question that was likened to a defense counsel opening the door to an issue that the counsel may not have wanted to open the door to.
Okay. Did you want to say anything about the jury instruction as to abandonment?
Yes, it was very clear from the very beginning because when Detective Hagenboo interviewed Mr. Lesnick that I thought it was abandoned, that his theory of defense would ultimately be abandonment. And when we were speaking about it regarding jury instructions, there was no issue from Mr. Hart or Mr. Lesnick. It was very clear that their theory of defense was abandonment. And unfortunately, there isn't a pattern jury instruction in criminal law that either of us could find that really addressed the abandonment issue. And the closest one that we could find was the one from that, I believe it's the 1920s case regarding mining. So we try to sanitize, we try to contextualize it for this issue because it is still a correct statement of law and that it requires an intent to abandon. So whether the defendant's honest but mistaken belief about something being abandoned also has to be put into context with issues like time, intent to abandon, and so on, so that the jury got a correct statement of law regarding the nuances of abandonment. And regarding the sufficiency of the evidence of abandonment, he testified, I'm sorry, Mr. Lesnick stated he knew that the ticket didn't belong to him, so the jury was able to weigh whether he actually did have an honest but mistaken belief in spite of his own statement saying he knew that he took something that didn't belong to him.
Can this even be abandoned, though, at least for 180 days or so? Because it seems that under, because we're unique, right? As a gaming state, there's gaming law that applies that if a player doesn't cash out the credits, then the casino takes temporary possession of those credits while they attempt to get them to the player, and then ultimately they would go to the state's general fund. So can that ever even be abandoned?
Under the analysis from the abandonment case, the mining case, it could be abandoned because someone could just simply say, yes, I intended to leave the 27 cents in the machine and I'm not ever coming back for it. Have fun with it. Because it addresses the intent to abandon, the time issue. As far as the honest but mistaken belief, if someone tells someone affirmatively, I'm abandoning this, honey, let's go home. I mean, at that point, it has been affirmatively abandoned, which is consistent with the Nevada law as far as the abandonment instruction goes.
Is there anything that you wanted to say about the sufficiency of the evidence? That was another big part of the brief.
Overall, there was an extraordinarily overwhelming amount of evidence in this case. So every single action that Mr. Lesnick took was caught on video. An extraordinary amount of it was actually redacted because of issues regarding potential other bad acts. But all of the actions that Mr. Lesnick took were shown by video, by multiple eyewitness testimony, by his own admissions. Everything was, I mean, quite frankly, caught on video. And then he ultimately confessed his intent at every point, his actions to at least one other witness who was in interaction with Mr. Lesnick at any point. So as far as any potential errors, I would submit that they are at best harmless in light of the overwhelming evidence against Mr. Lesnick.
Any further questions?
No?
I have no further questions.
So you got 10 seconds left.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel.
All right, Mr. Owens.
As it concerns the multiple offenses, as I read the gaming statute, it would seem to encompass all parts of this crime. The state wants to break it up and say the action of the machine is one crime, the ticket machine is another, and then the cashier is another. But if you look at the fraudulent acts in a gaming establishment, NRS 465.070, subparagraph 3, it applies and prohibits to claim, collect, or take, or attempt to claim, collect, or take money or anything of value in or from a gambling game with intent to defraud without having made a wager contingent thereon. All parts of what the state described there encompasses what the legislature set forth here, whether you're just taking that ticket that you did not earn through a proper procedures by wagering a money on the machine, and you just get the ticket from someone else and you go present it, that's still fraudulent act gaming. That gaming offense applies to that whole continuum of how you convert and take the money from the machine to a ticket to get cash. It's all encompassed within that gaming statute. So I don't think you get to cut off gaming and say gaming's complete at this point and add on the other actions, which are just a continuation of what was already completed, and say, well, now there's a separate statute, a separate offense that applies to each of these others. As for Drummond and the statute that says you can waive counsel and then use the preliminary hearing transcript, if that hasn't been addressed in the case law, I'm not sure this court needs to at this point, because even if theoretically a proper waiver in justice court of counsel does qualify constitutionally to allow the subsequent testimony in a trial, you don't have that waiver here. And so you can't even reach that analysis.
If it was error, why is it not harmless error? My understanding is that what Mr. Kim testified to is that he presented his ID, which is not disputed by Mr. Lesnick, and that he didn't ask, Mr. Kim didn't ask whether or not the ticket was stolen. My understanding is that there were other witnesses that presented duplicative testimony. So why is it not harmless error if the court did, in fact, allow this testimony improperly?
Well, it's a good question. I think with the other witness who testified through audiovisual, Bradley Winters, I think there's more apparent prejudice. But here the prior transcript was used, and the prejudice is that the defendant didn't know, or at least it's not clear in the record, that he didn't know that his cross-examination of this witness could be used later in trial if the witness was declared to be unavailable. So he was prejudiced. I know the quality of the cross-examination typically doesn't matter, but when you're talking about that it's a pro se defendant representing himself and he hasn't been advised of that, he may not, attorneys are on notice about that. They're deemed to understand that. The defendant didn't know here, and he may have answered different questions. The interaction at the window, the cashier, is important because the state is kind of suggesting that's where this material misrepresentation occurred, that the act of simply turning in the ticket and asking for money back, that there was some sort of implied material misrepresentation that he had made a wager on it. So I think that interaction, as an attorney, they would have cleared that up quite a bit more had that witness been called to testify and pinned down that Mr. Lesnick never did misrepresent anything to that cashier. And we're left with this implication that there was some sort of implied statement or something said to this cashier. So That's the prejudice I come up with for the cashier. Bradley Winters, I think, is the named victim. I think that's more important. And there's errors in the transcript there that show we don't have a complete record on appeal. The defendant doesn't have to show abandonment. And we're here talking about it today. Was it really abandoned? Can it ever be abandoned? I think that was the problem in the trial that got everyone hung up on. I found case law on it right away. I'm not sure why no one else did down below. And I, without even Westlaw, I could Google search and quickly come up with the way to take Mr. Lesnick's theory of defense and put it into legal terms. It's a mistake of fact defense. The jury didn't receive that. And so they didn't reach the right issues. We can't rely on this verdict. So I'll submit it.
Any other questions?
Thank you, counsel.
No. All right. Gentlemen, thank you both very much. Appreciate your work on the case and your arguments here today. The matter is going to stand submitted, and we will be in recess until the next call.